Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
To listen without ads, head over to patreon.com/rightandwrong.
Ooh, a spicy question. I
because
love
the it. Writing is sort of everything, right? Like, you can fix plot holes, but if the yeah. writing is
so some
there.
Readers love that, and some readers are like, but I wanted more of this. So it's kind of a gamble.
Hello, and welcome back to the Right and Wrong podcast. Today, I am joined by novelist and poet, Jodie Matthews. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good too.
We're on the... This episode will go out after the book is out, but we are currently sort of on the precipice, just a couple of weeks away from the book coming out. How are you feeling about everything?
Stressed. Very stressed. It's a strange situation to be in after, you know, a couple of years of knowing that it's coming, to suddenly be... right there. I think we're about 3 weeks out. It doesn't really feel real. None of it's felt real at any point, actually, if I'm honest. So it feels very strange to think that the book will be out there, or already is out there in some cases, as an actual object.
Yeah.
It's odd.
A physical thing that lots of people are going to be able to, like, pick up, hold, read, consume.
Yeah, hopefully lots of people. That would be great. That's the aim.
That's the growth. So let's talk about it. It's called Meet Me at the Service. It is your debut, out on the 15th of February. Tell us a little bit about it.
Okay, so Meet Me at the Service is a book about Maren, who is a young woman who grew up on Bodmin Moor, which is where, or near to where I grew up in real life. And she has moved to Manchester for university and to get away from her mother and her aunt, who she lives with. And she gets called back home by her mother for the memorial service of her ex-girlfriend. When she goes back to the farmhouse that she grew up in, everything is slightly off. No one will tell her when the memorial service is. There's weird things happening on the moors, and she has to uncover what's going on, essentially.
And it's a bit spooky. It's a bit sort of haunted and mysterious.
Yes. Yeah.
What was the, obviously, like you mentioned, it's close to where you grew up. Mm-hmm. And I know that you currently live in Manchester. So yes. Geographically, you and Maren followed a very similar path. Mm. But what was the kind of original inspiration for this?
Well, when I was writing it, I was actually living in the Midlands. And I'd lived, I've lived away from Cornwall at this point for 10 years. And I started to try and write a different kind of book, which I was really struggling with. So as I was struggling to write this other book, I decided to give myself a little break and just write something for fun. And I wrote a couple of thousand words quite quickly about a girl on a train going home to the moors and taking a long bath. And I wrote that and I was like, oh, this is really fun. This is what it's supposed to be like. So I kind of went from there, and I started writing at the end of 2019, early 2020, and I was working as a gardener at the time. So when lockdown happened, I was furloughed and I couldn't go back to Cornwall. So there was something about writing about home and writing about where I grew up whilst I was kind of stuck a couple of hundred miles away that I just found quite inspiring. I was kind of trying to write my way back, I suppose. And it all kind of came from there.
Oh, that's so interesting. So you weren't actually in Manchester at that time?
No, I moved to Manchester a year ago.
Oh, okay.
So it was, a little bit after I got the deal with Fourth Estate.
So you're actually following in Maren's footsteps?
A little bit, yeah. Except she's about 10 years younger than I am. I went to university. quite similar. Maren's footsteps, but with Stoke stuck in the middle.
Okay.
Yeah.
Via Stoke. That's fine. So from that, I'm going to speculate that you have you been writing like novels and things for quite a while before you wrote Meet Me at the Surface?
No, actually, Meet Me at the Surface was the first novel I wrote. So I kind of it was the first time I sat down and tried to write something full length. In that period at the beginning of 2020, I probably got about 10 or 20,000 words into a piece of historical fiction, which was just absolute garbage. And then I started again and wrote Meet Me at the Surface. So that was my first attempt. Before that, I'd written poetry and I'd done a bit of screenwriting, which also wasn't great, but was fun. kind of articles and essays, that kind of thing.
Right. Okay. So you kind of warmed up to it. You know, you started writing shorter form stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You did this historical fiction, which never made it to the finish line.
and then
you hit the ground running with this.
Mm-hmm.
As it was your kind of first thing, how many times did you kind of redraft it before you started putting it out to different like agents and competitions and things like that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I write in a bit of a weird manner, or in the way that a lot of people tell you you shouldn't, which is where you edit as you go along.
Oh, interesting.
Rather than kind of getting one full draft down and then going back and editing. I'm a bit of a perfectionist, and it really frustrates me if I know that something is wrong in the last bit. So I kind of spend a lot of time going over and over, say the first 20,000 words. I got about 40,000 words in, and then my very old, very broken laptop I was using broke, and I lost all of it and couldn't get it back. And I had to start again at that point, which was actually really good. At the time, I didn't think it was good. I thought it was a disaster, obviously. But having to rewrite that beginning was really helpful. I think I finished a draft, and then I started to enter into some competitions, and I started to work with a mentor as well and do things like that and kind of worked on it that way. And then I submitted to agents, I think, maybe summer of 2021. Yeah, so it was around a year after I started, I think.
It's really interesting that obviously you did it unwillingly, but one thing that I have heard many authors do is that they will write a first draft and then just put it to one side or like delete it and write the whole thing again, because in a way it's a really good way of kind of trimming the fat, because you remember everything that's important and everything that's not as important. You might not remember it as you're coming to rewrite it again. Did you find that?
Yeah, I think it's really admirable when people do that on purpose. I don't think I could. I did find it helpful in that, when the second time round to get those first 40,000 words down, I knew I had a general idea of where I was going with it. But I couldn't do that on purpose. I work with about 7 different Word documents open. And what I'll do as I'm writing and editing as I go is if I get to a point and I'm like, okay, I like some of this, but not all of it, I'll cut pieces and stick them into a new Word document and then go from there. And then that will be my newest version of it. And I kind of do it that way because I think I like working on a sentence level more so than kind of an overarching plot, which makes it difficult and long when it comes to editing, and you need to make sure that there's an actual story rather than just pretty words. I really like, I work in quite a close sentence level. So I think if I was to just delete everything, I'd be quite sad because I'd forget all of those little turns of phrase, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Because you especially when you are at that kind of point of working on a sentence level and you're like, wow, I'm so happy with this sentence and like this paragraph is so perfect. But then if someone comes along and says, this doesn't move the plot forward, we've got to get rid of it, it's sort of heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't mind it when other people want me to cut it. I'm just...
Oh, okay.
I find it really hard to cut myself for some reason. It's not because I think every piece is perfect. It's just because I find it hard to, I suppose, see through all of the weeds. But when it comes to editing, one of my favorite things is to just be told to cut huge chunks. So when I was first editing with Liv Maidman, who's my agent, that's what I said to her immediately. I was just like, please tell me what to get rid of. Help me get rid of full chapters. Help me get rid of everything. Because I just think editing is an entirely different skill, obviously. And it's so helpful to just, yeah, sort through all of the mess. But when it comes to drafting, I can't get rid of things just in case something in there is like the key to making it good. I think maybe I don't trust my own judgment enough to delete huge pieces of writing.
Yeah, that's what it sounds. I mean, authors are obviously like, no one is as close to the world and the characters as the author. So you often can't see the thing as a whole in the same way that someone from the outside coming in can see it. Because all they can see is what you've written down. Whereas you see what you've written down and then all of the rest of it, you know, the other 90% that's in your brain.
Yeah, exactly. I think outside eyes are so important for somebody else to kind of, I suppose, get to the point of what it is that you're trying to do. Whereas, when you're writing it in your head, you've got everything that you've ever thought about and all of your research and, this whole kind of wider world. And it's not all relevant. Of course it isn't. But
no.
It's hard when you find out that it isn't all that important.
I've seen lots of fantasy authors talk about it because obviously fantasy, there's a lot of world building that goes on in lots of those books, but they talk about it as like the iceberg where you see the small bit on top, but it's all the research, everything you created is the huge kind of mass, which is like 90% of the actual thing, but you're only ever showing 10%.
Yeah. I think that's definitely what it is, isn't it? It's you just try and create a whole life for these characters, and nobody wants to read their whole life, do they? Or maybe some people do, but it's not always as interesting as it needs to be.
But it kind of needs to exist without being said for everything to kind of come together, I think, at the end.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Let's talk about, so you mentioned, Olivia, your agent, and you mentioned that it was in 2021, I think it's the summer, you said that you started submitting to agents. Was it prior to that you put yourself forward for the Bath Novel Award and the Blue Pencil Novel Award? Because I know that you were shortlisted for both of those.
Yeah. So I entered both of those. I can't remember exactly when, but I got longlisted for both. And I think, if I'm remembering rightly, I got the offer of representation from Liv just after I was longlisted for the BPA. No, the BPA, sorry, the Bath Novel Award. So at that point, that was my second round of sending out to agents. My first round I sent out way too early when I'd just finished my first draft, and I went out, I think, to about 5 people. And then after that, I was working with Tom DeFreston, who is he's an artist and he's the author of a really great nonfiction book called Wreck. So he was kind of mentoring me on my writing and was encouraging me to put myself forward for awards and things like that. So like BAFTA and BPA. So I entered those, got longlisted, and sent out my second round. And that's when I sent my query out to Liv. I think I emailed her on like a Saturday or possibly a Sunday. And then I heard back from her on a Monday morning.
Wow.
To ask for the foot, which was crazy and was not the experience I'd had before. So that was really exciting. So I was like, oh, okay, something has gone right this time around, which was great.
I was going to ask if you did lots of editing with Olivia, but like you said, you kind of went in straight away and was like, tell me the bits that need to get taken out. Was there quite a lot of back and forth before you guys decided it was good to send to editors?
Yeah, there was a fair bit of editing. We immediately got rid of a character.
Oh, wow.
Which was very helpful. There was a man in the book. There aren't many men in the book as it stands now. But there was a guy in the book who was not necessarily a main character, but he took up a fair amount of the story. And we agreed to get rid of him. They've kind of pointed out that he was a bit boring, and she was right. So we killed him off quite quickly, restructured things in a way, kind of lent more into the mystery element of the story, I suppose. Put a bit more focus on plot, I guess, is probably the best way to describe what we did, because it was quite floaty beforehand, because I had a story, obviously, but like I said earlier, because I was kind of focusing on the sentence level, it was, you know, it was all vibes, no plot. So Liv really helped me make it into a book that would be a good experience to read, which was really good. And then we worked together from, yeah, maybe August, September until April of 2022, which is when we went out on submission.
Okay.
Yeah, and we went out on submission, heard back from Fourth Estate 24 hours after we went out on sub.
Wow, look at you.
Crazy. With
the,
I know.
You've got the 24-hour turnaround on this
it
one.
Was, yeah, it was, that was insane. I really wasn't expecting that at all. We went out on submission and I thought, okay, it's going to take 6 months or it's going to take 9 months. Mm. It's going to take a really long time. And yeah, I was still working as a gardener at this point as well. So I remember getting, I think we went out on a Monday and it was Tuesday lunchtime and I was mowing some grass. And then my phone started buzzing in my pocket and it was Liv messaging me being like, oh my God, Katie from Fourth Estate has just come back. She says she's read it. She loves it. And I was like, oh, it was crazy. It was very exciting.
Was she read the whole thing?
I think so. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I could be remembering it wrong, but I'm pretty sure she got it and she sat and read it straight through.
Wow.
And kind of immediately contacted Liv and was excited about it. And then obviously everything that comes after that takes a little while anyway.
Yeah.
I think that was such a relief because there's always that fear. Yeah.
How did you find when you got kind of paired with the editor, like actually working with an editor for the sort of final stage of editorial?
Again, I quite liked it. So yeah, so I was working with Katie Bowden and she just really loved the book and responded to it in the same way that Liv had, which was great. And there was no butting heads or anything like that. There were no kind of strong editorial decisions that went against anything that I thought. It was more just, I think, fine-tuning what me and Liv had worked on and kind of bringing certain characters out of themselves a bit more and things like that. So again, it was just a lovely experience. I think it's really nice to kind of take your work and push it towards somebody else and say, please help me. Like, please help me make this better. Please shine this up for me. And I think I just kind of trust them intrinsically that what they're going to suggest is going to be right and is going to help. And it did. And the book is much better than it would have been if I'd just kept the whole thing going by myself. So I was very happy. I mean, edits are still hard. I think, especially when it comes to proofreading and stuff like that, and you just get this blindness to your own work and also reading your own work over and over again. And once you get to the stage where, you know, you're not allowed to make any more big edits, but you still kind of want to. So that's the problem. I think I've been reading the book at the moment just to kind of prep myself for podcasts and, you know, things like this. And even now I kind of read through and I'm like, it's really hard to switch off that part of your brain that wants to cross out sections and change things around and make this sentence flow better. Yeah. So yeah, I think in an ideal world, you'd probably be able to edit continuously forever and you'd never have to have an actual finished product. But unfortunately, that's not the way it works.
I don't know how ideal that would be, but...
maybe not. Yeah,
I know exactly what you mean though. And I think it's the same with a lot of creative disciplines. I used to be very into music and lots of my friends are musicians and a lot of the time they'll write a song. They'll be really like excited about the song for about a week. And then a week, like if you ask them 2 weeks later, they'll be like, no, I can't stand to listen to that. It's the worst thing I've ever written in my life. I hate it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's decision fatigue, I think. I get it. It's obviously quite different, but I have tattoos and I get really excited when I when I find a tattoo and when I book in for a tattoo and when I very first get it done, I'm like, oh, this is great. And about an hour afterwards, I start to hate it and I panic and I'm like, I've just made a permanent decision and I shouldn't have done, and this is terrible. And it will take me about a day or so until I'm like, oh no, I do actually like this. This is fine. And I think it's similar with finishing the book or sending in a draft. You kind of, you're like, right, this is definitely good. I've done this. I'm happy with this. And then you send the email and then it's just like a spiral of, oh no, that was a terrible decision. That shouldn't have happened. And it takes a little while, I think, to get used to it and to kind of settle into the idea that, no, okay, that's done. And I've done as much as I can.
Yeah. It's hard to let go sometimes, right? Mm-hmm. It's because once it's gone, like, especially now, you know, once you've worked with the editor, it's like finished. The publisher's like, great, done. It's going to print. And you're like, you can no longer change it. Like, it's finalized.
Yeah. Yeah. Scary.
But it's going to be great. It is great. And it comes when it comes out, I'm sure many people are going to also think this is great and she didn't need to change anything. Speaking of writers and writing and publishing, lots of the listeners of this podcast are writers looking to learn about publishing and sort of know what to expect once you get your foot in the door. So throughout this whole kind of process, I wonder if, were there any parts of it that maybe like surprised you or you weren't expecting?
That's an interesting question. I think I had a general idea of how everything worked because I was running my Instagram account for maybe a year or so before I started writing the book, and I was reviewing books on there. So I'd worked with some PR teams for publishers and I'd done some social media stuff for them, so I had a vague idea, and I was following lots of published writers as well, so I could kind of see how long the process took. I suppose it's still a bit of a surprise when you do, you know, you sign your deal and you know that your book is coming out. And I think I signed mine, yeah, in 2022. And then when it's like, right, okay, this is going to come out in 2024, it still feels like such a long time.
Yeah.
And that's a kind of weird liminal space to be in when you know that this thing that you've wanted for so long is going to happen, but just not yet. That was quite strange. And then I changed my title a few times. But again, that wasn't so much unexpected because I knew that that happened. But it was still a strange process to kind of be stood, you know, at work on my phone with Liv, my agent, kind of throwing titles back and forth at each other as we tried to figure out, you know, what suggestions we should make to the publisher when we knew that we needed to change it.
Was there then kind of a discussion about changing it once it was with the publisher, or is the title that we have, Meet Me at the Surface, is that one that you and Olivia came up with?
So yeah, it was changed once we'd made the deal with Fourth Estate. So it actually changed a few times. When I was when I was first working on it by myself, there was a period of time where I'd called it Sulking Room, which wasn't really relevant to anything. I just liked it. I think I was still in the habit of naming poems. So we did that. And then I had another title for a while, which is what I submitted it to live under. It was called A Single Drop of Sea. But then as we edited, the sea became less important in the story. So before we went out on submission and sent it to Fourth Estate, I renamed it again. And I called it Spriggan, which me and Liv both really liked. And that's what it went out to Fourth Estate under, that title. And Katie really liked that title as well. But we had a discussion where essentially because it's a Cornish word, because it's a, you know, a word that's associated with folklore, we've decided that we needed something that was kind of more recognizable, I suppose, that, you know, a title that would make more sense to people who might not have come across that word before, because we didn't want anything on the book, I suppose, that would deter people from picking it up,
yeah,
which I think makes a lot of sense. So yeah, then we bandied ideas back and forth. And I think it was Liv who came up with Meet Me at the Surface. We kind of we discussed a few different ones and nothing really felt right. And then, yeah, Liv sent over the idea of Meet Me at the Surface, and we were all just like, oh yeah, that works. So that was really good. I'm very happy that we ended up where we ended up with it.
Yeah, it's a good one. And I think it's one thing you can definitely expect is, I think more often than not, there'll be several iterations of a title for a book when it goes through different stages of publishing and production.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's important not to be too precious about it as well. It's just kind of, that's how I've tried to be with every step of the process, I guess, is just as open as possible to any suggestions, and to kind of to think of the book as a changeable thing rather than a fixed object. So I haven't gone into it saying, this is my story and this is exactly how it needs to be told, and this is what it needs to look like, and this is what the cover needs to look like, and this is what the title needs to be. I've kind of tried my best to, yeah, just be as open to any changes that need to be made. And I think that's really helped and made it an easier process as well.
Yeah, 100%. Because I also think if you're kind of interested in looking at going down a traditional publishing route and working with, you know, a team and stuff like that, it is a team effort. And, you know, between your agent and your editor and everyone else at the publishing house, everyone's trying to make this book as good as it can possibly be. But if you want to create something that's entirely, wholly, authentically you, then there's probably other avenues that might work better for that kind of book.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, the publishers, they know how to sell it. And that's one thing, for me at least, like I know how to write the story, but that's as far as my ability goes. That's as far as my job goes. So if they have an idea or they know a way that to get it into more hands, or to make it appeal to more people, or to get it to reach the right audience, then obviously I'm going to listen to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They've got the experience and the kind of knowledge and things like that. Yeah. And as much as you hear the phrase, like, don't judge a book by its cover and things like that, it's like, the reality is a lot of books, and I myself judge a lot of books by the cover, not necessarily in like a bad way, but if I see a nice cover, I will go over and look at what the book is. You know what I mean? You see a catchy title, you're like, oh, intriguing, I must read more.
Yeah, of course. Covers are so important. They're so important. I'm like a magpie when it comes to them as well. So I definitely, I understand that. And I'm very happy with mine, which is great as well.
Yeah, it's really nice. That was one thing I was worried about.
Thank you. Yeah. But one thing I was worried about before I kind of started the process was, oh, what if I get lumped with, you know, quite early on, I was trying to imagine what the book would be like when it was done. And I was like, oh gosh, what if I get lumped with a really ugly cover? And luckily that didn't happen at all. We were, yeah, everyone was very happy as soon as the cover was kind of shown to us for the first time. I got the email through.
Yes.
And was immediately like, this is perfect. And there were a couple of tweaks, but nothing major, which was nice. I was just pleased it had an eel on it, to be honest.
That was the one thing you wanted. Mm-hmm. It's a really nice cover. And anyone listening, go check it out. It'll be available to buy as of this airing. But at minimum, go and check out the cover because it's really nice and there's an eel on it. And that brings us to the final question, which is the same in every episode. Jodie, if you were stranded on a desert island with a single book, which book do you hope that it would be?
I love this question. So I actually pulled two off my bookshelf to try and think about this. And they're both really chunky because I feel like that is an important element to this. So I have, it would be a choice between Stephen Chbosky's Imaginary Friend, which is, I think, about 800 pages and very scary and very odd, which now I'm thinking about it, if I was on a desert island, would probably be terrifying to reread, but also just infinitely interesting. And then also Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Susanna Clarke, which is about 1,000 pages. So it would be a toss up between one of those, both of which I've only read once. but probably, yeah, mainly for the sheer length of them and for the slight weirdness that both of them have that I think would keep things interesting.
If you had to pick one, which would it be?
At the moment, I would lean towards Imaginary Friend.
Okay.
Yeah.
The way you say at the moment makes me think that in like 10 minutes, you're going to be like, no, I changed my mind.
Maybe. I'm leaning more towards horror in general in everything okay. that I'm reading and watching and kind of, yeah, partaking it.
Right, horror is really having a moment right now, I think, in the kind of popular sphere, because it like television, movies, books, horror is really, people love it.
Yeah, it's just fascinating. I think it's the one thing that's keeping me interested, I think, at the moment, especially when I'm, you know, there's a lot going on, the launch of the book coming up and everything's a bit stressful. And I think the escapism of horror is exactly what I need. So if I was stuck on a desert island right now, it would be Imaginary Friend.
Okay, amazing. Very cool answer. I also liked your runner-up as well. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Jodie, for coming on the podcast and telling us all about the book, Meet Me at the Surface, and your writing process and your writing journey. It's been really cool chatting with you.
Thank you. It's been really fun.
And for anyone listening, if you want to keep up with what Jodie is doing, you can follow her on Twitter at Jodie R. Matthews or on Instagram and TikTok at Jodie Rianne Matthews. To make sure you don't miss an episode of this podcast, follow along on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook. You can support the show on Patreon. And for more Bookish Chat, check out my other podcast, The Chosen Ones and Other Tropes. Thanks again to Jodie and thanks to everyone listening. We'll catch you in the next episode.